It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
I drove my kid to school.
You drove your kid to school?
Yeah, he's back.
He's back in school.
Yeah.
You drove your kid to school today.
Yeah, he's back.
Just like a kindergarten kid or?
Oh, high school kid. The kindergarten kids go soon enough.
Well, you think about the kindergarten, more like you took your kid to school or you take your kid to college, which is high school.
It's his first year in high school.
So what did this mean?
I don't know.
What did this mean to you?
He was nervous.
He was nervous.
It was, it's just one of those things, I asked him last night, what are you nervous about? I don't know, Dad.
New school.
It's new school. It's new place.
So he's not kind of gone on with his friends in a public school. You're taking him to private.
He's going to a private school, and he knows a handful of different folks. We know a lot of different teachers and people there and stuff like that. I think it really is it's just that longing to be a part and known in a community, and this is all fresh and new, and he doesn't have his established place. And I think for a lot of people, that's a huge deal. I think it's a lot of people on this journey, when they lose that by, quote, stepping out of where they had that, that's part of the profound disorientation that they go through.
Yeah, and it's the quick thing is, how do we get back into that place of feeling like we...
Or how do I reestablish that with some sort of external handholds that make me feel secure in that? And I guess in this whole journey, I've sort of realized there's really only one place you're ever going to get that's going to really be secure, and that's found in a person named Jesus. I wasn't going to give him that Sunday school answer on the way in, like, well, just remember Jesus, Jared.
Jesus with you today. It'll be great.
But
I do think people who get comfortable on this journey ultimately get comfortable with temporal uncertainty.
I don't see it that way at all.
And nobody wants to. Nobody really wants to live there. But I honestly think
they don't even think there is there. They don't see it as temporal uncertainty.
They don't?
I don't think so.
Well, they wouldn't call it that. But I just think when life is certain and therefore we feel comfortable and assured, then we like fall off the cliff when life takes its turn again, or 4 years he's
and they're surprised.
In 4 years he's gonna be to college somewhere.
Right.
After that he'll drive
him there again, I guess.
Get a job somewhere.
Send him off.
I think the real people who enjoy this journey learn to enjoy uncertainty. Learn to enjoy life with God in uncertainty, rather than I'm gonna prop up all the uncertainty with more false certainty. So in that class, and I really do think the people that have most fun on this journey are people who just, I'm comfortable with the fact that it's just today, and I'm going to live inside this day, and I'll let the next one unfold, and I'm not looking to reprop up my false illusions.
Do you know a lot of people that do that?
No. I'm just saying the happiest ones.
I know.
There's 18 I know worldwide.
Yeah. Somehow. I feel like that's a place that God has graciously brought me to a place of going like, gosh, I used to be get all the ducks in a row. I used to kick down the doors that I wanted to go through. And now I just go like, gosh, I don't even want to kick. I hardly want to knock sometimes. You're just going like, you know what, Lord, help me see what this is and help me respond to whatever I can discern you're doing. But my answer to most of this, I don't know. And I used to not have that as one of my answers.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to find your comfort in your circumstances all being arranged the way you like them, you're not going to be happy very many days of your life. There are days where everything just aligns. Life is good. There's money in the bank account. My friends like me. There's days like that. And then there's real life.
But it is exhausting to try to string a few of those together.
It's the antelope going down to the pond, not knowing the crocodile is out in the pond. It's back to that.
You've been watching Planet Earth.
Oh, boy. Yeah, no, I don't think many people have learned to live there, because as much as we talk about finding our certainty in Jesus...
We talk about that?
It's much easier to find it in circumstances I can control or circumstances I like.
I talk about accepting uncertainty with Jesus. I don't get a whole lot of certainty.
You don't.
I don't.
I don't either. I hear you.
I mean, I ask for it. It's like, hey, Lord, right? You know, it'd be nice to see the next 5 years at a glance, just have a sense of, you know, how to prepare and plan for them. And,
right. And we spend most of our life fighting for some illusion of certainty. But we just don't know it's an illusion. That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's just good now. Great. Enjoy it while it's good now. And when it all goes to...
But that's the one thing I think I get sacrificed all the time. I don't see a lot of people settling in the enjoyment of now.
I see more and more, but I agree with you. I think everything about our culture pushes us the other direction.
I see people stuck in the past and afraid of the future.
Yeah.
And I'm going like, I don't like either of those addresses.
I hear you. John wrote us a neat little note, said, you'll be pleased to know that after I listened to your last podcast and the replaying of Father Festus's voicemail, or excuse me, Fester's voicemail, actually went on Amazon to find the book, The Shark. Oh, whoa, John. Wow. He ends with this, boy, do I now feel stupid. I should have finished listening to the whole thing. Yeah, Fester got him looking for the shark on Amazon. I told him it might be a good book title we'd use.
I had someone last night at some orientation thing say, this guy had something to do with that book. What's that book called? The Shed? No, it's The Lost Box. It's The Shark.
The Shark. No, it's still The Shack, as far as I know. Hilarious, though. I actually heard from Fester this week. He said that our little putting him on our podcast had jumped his views on YouTube in a huge way. And he said...
He's funny.
He is funny. I don't know if you've seen... He's got some other stuff on there. I don't know if you've looked...
I tried. I didn't have the right download size. It was
I listened to a couple of it. He just said this was a little gag thing he pulled, and it's becoming kind of a little cottage industry for him. His little alter ego, Fester, so...
We launched Fester.
Fester Coots, if you want to hear him. Boy, I guess book to follow. Who knows?
I found out how to morph my picture like that with my Mac. I make a good-looking Fester. I do.
Oh, he doesn't really look that way?
I don't see.
He never had a little pinched-in,
no.
Pear-shaped head?
I got his kids or his twins or something like that, and friends on Facebook as well.
Wow.
I got a Fester family going.
Gosh. You know, I had lunch with a pastor last week.
Uh-oh, how'd that go?
Local guy. It's interesting. I've told Sarah, you know, we've been down in this area now, this particular area, for about 4 years, and it's kind of like getting where Oxnard was after we'd been there about 4 years. I mean, there's just all kinds of connections now coming with people who are in traditional systems and who are really trying to think outside the box. This guy wants me to come share with their congregation one Sunday, and so I gave him, so you don't want to go to church anymore, so now I'm not sure if he really wants me to come.
You may be disinvited.
He read that he loves me. They're loving it. Their congregation's studying it. You come speak. And anyway, this is an interesting thing he said, though. This is a South African who's lived in Australia for a long time. He's got an Australian accent, a little twang of South African in there from time to time. But he talked about back when he got saved, he's had a great time learning to live in Jesus and to live in his love. And then he was told how to be a good Christian and start working hard. And then he could no longer feel God's presence in his life. And he asked his pastor one day.
He worked his way right out of it.
Well, he just asked his pastor, what's happened? Here was the answer.
Oh, no. Wait, hang on. I'm listening.
The honeymoon is over.
What?
It's time to live by faith, not by feelings.
The marriage hasn't even happened.
The honeymoon's over.
No. The marriage. We're not even at the marriage supper of the Lamb yet. How could the honeymoon be over? We're just getting introduced.
Well, you know what he meant. He meant it's only fun for 6 months. After that, it sucks. And that's the party line. I'm telling you. I remember using that 2 Corinthians 3 scripture. We used to talk about from glory to glory, he's changing us. Or
you
glory
better get him to sign up for them programs early.
We used to say in the original Greek what Paul really said was, from pit to pit, he's changing me. Because how we taught it. And then he said this. I thought this was a great insight. At the end of that little thing, he said, you know, I've realized now that I was living by faith before and was living by works then.
Whoa.
Now, I tell you what, if we could.
Whoa.
That's powerful thinking. Those first 6 months when you just thought Jesus loved you and you didn't have to perform.
That's a powerful acknowledgement.
It is.
Yeah.
That's faith. I'm loved. That's faith. Works is, I better earn this love that I don't feel.
So he'll keep loving me.
Yeah. That's where we've screwed
it up. It doesn't put any gas in the tank.
It doesn't.
No. I mean, why in the world? I mean, think about it. I know it'd be hard to sort of kind of rewind back to an old mindset, but why in the world would you want to saddle or, quote, harness someone's initial passion in such a way that you snuff it out?
Because it made us uncomfortable. Because my reality was,
now, yeah. For all of our listeners, Wayne right now has his finger pointed right at me. He is passionate.
I'm sorry. I will disarm my right hand.
Made us feel uncomfortable. Well, tell me more.
Well, our reality was this has turned into a long, slow slog for God. And to have those new convert people happy and free and then also doing stupid things, that helped. Because they didn't know the rules well yet, so they were still having fun. When we get them the rules, they will learn to have the deep inner joy that is there even in the midst of great pain.
You think as thou art speaking, King James.
An agony. And then they'll be real Christians because they're as bored as we are. If we were still...
Misery loves company is the common denominator.
If we were still living in that joy, we would let that joy define maturity. But because we weren't, we wanted maturity to define by keeping the rules, darn it. The rules are important,
well.
And it's dangerous. Here, we got this from Nancy. I love this. 6 years out of organized Christian religion, and I'm feeling a whole lot less dangerous to myself and others. That's a great statement. 6 years out.
I got to tell you, light bulbs are going all over the country.
Oh, and I'm feeling a whole lot less dangerous too. I think that's the joy of this transition. And don't hear that as stop going to Sunday morning. It's stop living religiously. Stop living by performance. You can still hang out with whoever you want to on Sunday mornings. We don't care. But don't live in the whole performance-based guilt ethic stuff.
Yeah, I mean... I don't know. I'm lost. I lost my old mindset, and I just don't understand. Why would you want to just quench someone's excitable passion?
You don't want to. You feel like you have to. To really help them mature and start being more disciplined and mature.
I don't know about that.
I understand, but it happens all the time.
I know.
And I did it.
I understand.
And I wouldn't want to do it. I hear God, I don't want to do it. I don't mean to do it. I'm sorry for doing it.
My kids pull that.
What do your kids pull that?
My kids pull that. I didn't mean to. Well, it's like the outcome's the same. It doesn't matter.
I didn't mean to. I said, I didn't want to. No, I hear you. One gal wrote me yesterday, she just in this transition, and she said she went back to her old congregation Sunday, and a dear, dear friend of hers is the pastor of that thing. And she said, I couldn't sit through all the crap he was saying. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to use that word.
No, I just think it's hilarious. We just go like, that's the honest response of someone sitting there reverently in a pew going, I can't see through all this crap.
The canary has died in the cage. Why don't the rest
in
of
the
us,
tunnels.
Why the rest of us get out of the mine? Oh, I when you sit in that thing, Dave Coleman, our Jake Colson friend, Dave always says is this, when you live in religion, you need that flagellation every Sunday morning, the guilt that makes you try and work harder. You actually learn to enjoy it.
Why do you need that?
Because you know you're not doing well and you deserve a good beating and you feel good better after your verbal little beating, after your ass whooping by the pastor. Sorry, Julie. After that, you just feel, that's what he says. Now,
pastor really gave it to us today.
I never got that. But he said, when you see through it, then you just can't sit through it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I look at it as tragedy now.
Absolutely.
I go like, golly, I still remember, I think we talked about this. You know, I got my kids on Easter Sunday sitting out on the, you know, lawn out in Malibu and there's outdoor service and stuff like that. And all three kids are looking at me like, Dad, this is not the truth.
Why are we doing this? Do we not like ourselves anymore?
No, Mom suggested we go.
Oh, put it on the woman.
Full on.
The woman
full
that God
on.
Gave
the conversation
me.
Walking back to the cars. Are you now satisfied? Do we have to do this again?
Kids didn't like it.
No, they all looked at me like they were confused. Because we just had that conversation the night before, and they're going like, Dad, that's not the wrong answer.
Did they think they'd been bad that you drug them off to this
They were wondering what their punishment was. What do we do?
Oh, and they got this from Kent, Missouri. This harkens back to an old podcast, the one we did on the one about lies.
Uh-huh.
Mistakes were made, but not by me. That book.
That's your T-shirt.
I love that shirt. I don't have it. Anyway, he wrote about the chapter on marriage. It's called Love's Assassin, Self-Justification of Marriage. He said, it's so telling. As I was reading it, I couldn't help but think of the destructive scenario that the religious system creates for young couples that then leads to unhealthy unions that create such damaged, arrogant, self-justifying people. Or the other option, damaged, broken, self-hating, deflated people. The effect is broken relationships all around, and too often those that remain together are just examples of the unhealthy hierarchical variety. One rules, one submits. It's just so disturbing and sad what religion and the fallen mind has done to the relational life Father created for us. Relationship to Him in all His fullness, relationship to each other, and relationship to the natural world He created for us to live in. It's all been reduced to power, unless we die to that adventure. Unless we die to that adventure and missing the point. Forget that last bit. It's ugly. but isn't that true? That we really, religion
creates. The whole hierarchy
dynamic,
the sense of roles and the sense
and
of
submission
place
and who's in charge and power. And it's not always, I mean, we talked about that earlier this morning. It's not always the guy who's in power in the relationship.
How about rarely?
Rarely, you say?
Hey, that's who I'm bumping into these days.
Who's in charge if it's not the guy?
No, I tell
Ephesians
you, there's,
5,
there's,
submit
there's
wives, submit.
There's a amount of, there's a new epidemic called emasculation going on. And I'm not advocating the guys rule something thing.
Yeah, I know you're not.
Not at all. Yeah, you're just going like, well, no, wait a minute. But I do see this cowering so as to please, and you're just going like.
To please an angry, threatening woman.
Well.
Yeah?
You would think. There, you know, without painting with a masterfully big brush. I'm looking at situations where you're going like, golly, these are not two people in dialogue. This is one ruling over the other, and it's just as disturbing and wrong as it was in the patriarchal days of the guys in charge. We're just going like, I think we're meant to be doing this in harmony together, and if you're not in harmony, I think you better stop and figure out what's going on.
Sarah said something interesting one time about a couple we'd spent a little bit of time with. And she came away from the conversation. She said, that wife doesn't respect her husband. I don't really. I mean, I didn't pick that up at all. But she said, no respect. No respect at all. And I tell you, one of the signs of a healthy relationship is a mutual respect and a mutual love. Neither one pulling the strings to make the other do what they don't want to do, but finding that place of, look, I love you and respect you enough that we got to find a way to us. We got to find a way that is the best of both of us.
You know, unless you're driving the car by yourself, it would seem to me that the only real way forward on a happy journey is to be going someplace that everyone has a heart agreement that says, yeah, that's where we want to go.
And no one's being drug along.
Yeah. I mean, it is not a fun journey if you got a passenger in the car that doesn't want to go.
We're back to uncertainty, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, but I also think that back to the whole issue of coercion and manipulation, it's like, you know what? I find myself void of any meaningful skills to convince someone to do something they don't want to do. And yet I was told that was leadership.
Oh, I was too.
You know, it's your capacity to get somebody to do what they don't want to do.
Bill
That's
Gothard,
a leadership.
Bill Gothard Junior Pharisee School. I went to that.
That's a terrorist.
Oh,
that goes nowhere.
No, it doesn't.
And it has profound resentment.
But isn't that
the natural backlash?
It does. Isn't the reason we feel like we have to control our spouse, our partner, our life, people we integrate with in life, our friendships, is because we want that certainty that you give me if you'll do what I want you to do and what I expect you to do and doggummit what I demand that you do.
I guess I'm not on that page.
No, I'm not on that page either, but I think that's where that is derived from. I'm going to find my certainty. Here's how Dave Coleman said it again.
Good job, Dave.
Whenever our personal well-being depends on the response of another person, we will manipulate them.
We got to have that guy back.
Well, I quote that just about every place I go. I think it's true. If you're not whole without your wife or husband, you won't be whole when they do everything you want. You still won't be whole.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you still won't be well. You won't have a sense of well-being. When you've manipulated, it's what you're talking about, when you've manipulated people on your journey, you're not going to enjoy that journey either because they're not there because they want to be. They're there because you keep pulling out your whip and beating them back into submission.
Yeah, or performing for them, bribing them, doing whatever it is to get them to then find pleasure in you. And it's like, gosh, if that's where your sense of identity, value, self-worth,
certainty,
comfort, whatever,
certainty,
if it comes from anything out of that well, I pity that life. It doesn't work. It's very painful, and it's profoundly insecure.
Yeah.
Now look at just the... You know, my life consists of looking at my kids' lives and helping them navigate through the insecurity of teenagerhood. And you're just going like, my gosh, if you can give someone the gift of just finding some sense of security, finding some sense of, you know, just being able to compliment someone in a way that kind of makes them relax a little bit, where they're not in that performance mode. The reward is you get to enjoy the best out of that person.
You get to enjoy a real person.
Yeah.
Even if they're frustrated and angry, at least you're not getting some... Yes! Real is 10 times better. Husbands, wives, respect your partner. Love them enough to let them be who they are and find a way to us together. Just find a way to find those things that, yeah, we can partner in as wholeheartedly as a couple and do together and enjoy and... Gosh, stop doing that crap.
Yeah, I've watched a whole bunch of relationships where it's like, you know, there is one spouse that tends to either scream the loudest, you know, rule the roost through some form of I'm going to get my way and the other one is pacifying it.
Yeah.
Life is better if I just somehow acquiesce and make this better. And you're just going like, I watch this from outside and you're just going like, how are either of you enjoying that?
Right.
You're choosing the lesser of potentially two bad outcomes, but that's not good.
Especially in a religious construct, if somebody pulls out the divorce card, I'm going to divorce you. And so you do everything you have to do to conform to what their expectation or demand is. Do you know what? Both of you end up suffocating in that marriage.
Call their bluff. I mean,
both of you end up suffocating in that marriage. You do.
Yeah.
It's not healthy for either one. It's not healthy for the power person, and it's not healthy for the person that just tucks their tail between their legs and denies who they really are to get along with someone they think they have to get along with, even if they're being abused.
How is what you have any different than what they're threatening?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, at that moment, relationship going on there.
Sarah has never pulled that card. I have no idea.
Well done.
We're in it together. Let's find a way through it. Now, we got dinged from last week.
You're kidding.
No, we got...
On what?
We got talking about...
Entitlement, manipulation, coercion, all that other stuff?
Yeah, and then we blended a lot of stuff together, because a lot of my entitlement rants... And we got some people who just said, it's politics. I won't listen to it. Stupid guys, get off the politics. But actually, we got some... the Cash for Clunkers program, which really ticked me off big time. And then we lumped that in with the whole health insurance thing, entitlement thing, and I think the conversation got really blurred. But
I saw a commercial about Cash for Clunkers and how the government's going to give you, and I sat there going, the government's not giving you. You're getting my money.
That's right. Here's Patty. I've been self-employed virtually all my adult life. I've never had an employer help pay my taxes or my health insurance. In fact, most of my life I've been without health insurance because I couldn't afford it. I don't have health insurance now. By the time I pay my taxes, there isn't enough left to pay the huge health insurance costs, since I'd be paying it all up front. In addition, I have a health condition that, while it has been taken care of, precludes me from getting any health insurance at all. Now, I don't feel entitled to this kind of care, but it sure would have been nice. There are many people like me who are self-employed, who have lost jobs and hence their health insurance, who really would appreciate at least basic medical care being available for emergencies. But our proposed health care bill isn't actually about nationalized health care. It's about nationalized health insurance. It isn't the same thing. My daughter had the opportunity to live in one of those supposedly horrible European countries that many Americans consider socialist, and it was a wonderful place to live. They don't have homeless people in the parks and doorways because the government helps out the poor and indigent to make them to make sure they have their basic needs.
There's no homeless people in Europe. I beg to differ.
Yes, their taxes are high. This could be Luxembourg or Belgium or something. Anyway, we are the only civilized Western nation without some kind of universal health care. I don't think it speaks well of us, actually. I think it speaks of our selfishness, our greed among the haves, and our idolization of independence above the welfare of the community. Way to go, Patty. I tell you what.
God bless Patty, but I don't know that I agree with everything there.
I agree with a lot of it. So you and I are on a different page.
We might be.
Because I agree. I think that I've been self-employed most of my life. The only time we had a decent health insurance program was when Sarah worked for the government.
Okay, as someone who's also been self-employed, right. I kind of go like, you know what? I've been an employer, I've been an employee, I've been self-employed.
You've done everything.
I have.
You're my hero.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
To say that the only health insurance I get is when my employer does it is not true. None of that's ever true. You can purchase your own health insurance.
If you don't have a pre-existing condition. Ever been denied health insurance?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. And you go, what the hooey is that? You only want to insure healthy people. Are the insurance companies being any more responsible than Congress is about this? No, they're not. No. I think that's true.
I think you can reform those elements. But I do think in the whole, I mean, the whole insurance thing, it's a collective approach to a problem.
The spreading risk.
Yeah. And so I get there, it's like, you know what? That's nice when it is done on a voluntary basis by a collective of people that say, you know what? Somehow we're going to spread the risk where it's not about fairness. It's not about I'm entitled to that. It's the only effort to say, gosh, any one person get totally wiped out by something like this, and because we're trying to avoid that, we're going to somehow aggregate this thing over a whole bunch of people, that if they all pay in, some are going to pay and some are going to lose, and somehow the outcome is good for all. It's all fear-based.
Not all fear-based. I reject fear-based. The accusation, actually.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. Here's Peter in Oz. I'll let him take you to the task here. He says, all right, with some trepidation, but okay, here's the elephant in the global room. For those of us living elsewhere in the world, Australia in my case, the U.S. presents us with many contrasts. We see a nation with a dominant and highly vocal Christian faith, but also a nation which scores rather poorly. Yeah, that's an oxymoron, but I'll give him that. Stop interrupting me.
Sorry.
Scores rather poorly on some measures of compassionate civilization. For example, lack of health care, high levels of poverty, and high levels of incarceration. This podcast provides a good snapshot of an apparent dichotomy. You guys have done so much to advance the message of God's empowering and freely given love, as opposed to a performance based on do good, get good religion. The podcast, The Shack, and so much more all point to the redeeming power of God's unearned favor. So why then do we also get the clear social political message from you that unearned favor, welfare, corrupts? That such unearned favor will breed a demanding expectancy and dependency. Can it be argued that the message of Jesus is to be compartmentalized in its application? God is clearly prepared to take the risk of his unearned favor being taken advantage of. Do we have a better plan? Should it really burn us up inside if we see someone else getting something they don't deserve? Should we all get what we deserve, or just other people? In other words, I get the theory. I'm just struggling finding it in the application. Any thoughts here?
Yeah, a bunch. Thank you.
You did.
You get my ire.
And I wish to disavow myself from
this
rebuttal.
Yeah, yeah. The opinions expressed on this podcast are not shared by whatever.
Go for it, Brad.
You know, the reality is with God, you're dealing with an unlimited supply.
Okay.
You can't exhaust his love. Therefore, there is no responsibility issues how do we meet that out? Okay? We're not talking about the same dynamics. When you're talking about something that ultimately has an earthly price tag to it. You don't get to play by the same unlimited dynamics. If we did, I have no problem. But the problem is you can't. And at somebody at the end of that equation, somebody is spending beyond what they have, and therefore someone is becoming a debtor, someone else is a creditor. Someone's going to get hurt badly in that equation because you're not dealing with reality anymore. If you're dealing with a concrete thing of economics, you're confused.
Well, I'm not sure the question is there. The question is, do we have a compassionate society? Do we care, as almost every other civilized country has some form of universal health care? And I would argue that we do, too. I would argue
that our
emergency rooms cannot throw people out. I mean, people get health care.
I mean, does America have compassion? Is there any other nation on the planet that gives in terms of foreign aid elsewhere?
Okay, he's not talking about that. Stay to the point. Why would you not want a poor person down the road to get health care, even if it costs you a bit more?
On the last podcast, I said I'm all for that. Okay. I'm not against that.
Now you're pointing at me.
No, I'm pointing to the email right there.
He's pointing at you, Peter.
So the dynamic is, I think that that's wonderful. But we're dealing with a utopian fantasy that isn't... Okay.
No.
Explain to me how we have unlimited resources to address this issue.
Well, I've traveled in a lot of these countries that have universal health care.
Thank you.
And I've never heard anyone complain. This is horrible. We should stop this. We all want our own doctors back, our own, because they don't have their own doctors. Most of them, you can go to whatever doctor you want to go to. But I've never heard a country say, boy, having health care readily available to every citizen is a bad thing.
No, I think
and our current culture of where you have the money, you can get all the health care you want, and there are people who... I would argue you can't get any, because I think you can get some. But as Patty says, if you're playing by your little rules of being a creditor, not a debtor in society, whatever, you can get completely bankrupted by a medical need in this country.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a way. Our insurance companies don't deal fairly with it. I don't think government entitlement is necessarily the answer. But, you know, without some society addressing it.
Right.
We're going to waste a lot of money.
But guess what? Here's the context from which I'm speaking. Jonathan fell 40 feet off of a chairlift, ruptured his spleen, was in emergency care in ICU for
Did he fall or was he pushed?
He fell. Okay, he went to sleep. I was right there with him nearly wanting to jump. It was terrible.
I can't imagine.
It bankrupted us. It took me 5 years to pay it off.
You didn't go bankrupt.
It spent everything. I had to then, in terms of could I pay for it? No, I had to plead for a 5-year plan to be able to pay this off, and we worked it off. I am not unacquainted with falling through the cracks because we had care. We were just outside of our network.
But wouldn't you have appreciated?
Oh, I would have profoundly appreciated if there was some help somewhere, somebody, something. But the reality is that I don't think... welfare mindset that was equated by somebody else, I don't think that's the same thing as we're all in need of God's love. I really rankle about the equating of the message of the gospel.
I can see you rankling.
And the responsibility of each one of us as citizens and the need of the fact that you cannot mandate that people voluntarily. I mean, George, you read the dead guy stuff.
Yeah, he said you can mandate it. You often do need to mandate it because people won't freely choose to help each other.
It doesn't work.
This from Jane. I agree with the person from Australia. Sometimes our lives encounter illness. Our family's been through a great deal of it. I find many Christians interpret this as a result of sin in our lives. I know Christians who cannot afford...
Which is equally disturbing.
I know Christians who cannot afford health insurance who proudly proclaim that they aren't dependent on the state but on God. They honestly think that they face a healthcare crisis like we have, that God will meet their need. In reality, most of those I have known who have this attitude when really facing a crisis feel that they're entitled to God providing the money. But sometimes God doesn't come through in the way we think, and they end up in government programs anyway. My daughter was able to become a CNA through a Voc rehab program. We were financially bankrupt after putting her through treatment for an eating disorder. You know how our church handled it? They ignored us. Not financial support whatsoever. In their eyes, the ED was a result of sin. But God has restored our fortune and blessed us beyond our imagination. But through this, we've become compassionate. Many Christians claim to be givers and community-minded, but they aren't doing it in the real world. If you don't want an entitlement culture, you and people like you will need to participate in service through political office. But instead, you leave it up to those who will give their time and then stand back and criticize them. I'm very disappointed in the podcast I'm hearing right now.
Wow. This person would...
Go, Jane, go!
Yeah, this person would profess to know in our hearts to call us a you.
A you?
Yeah. I mean, to lump us into a group that it's like, you know what?
Okay, hold it. She's just trying to engage the conversation. Have a little respect for the point.
I do have respect for the point, but...
Don't be so threatened by that.
I'm not threatened by the accusations, but I'll be honest. For me, where I'm at, this is Brad's own opinion.
Yep.
I don't think people are served by that sense of when I'm in trouble, I'm entitled to expect somebody else to help me. I don't think that that helps.
I agree with you.
So I'm using that as my foundation of going like, you know what? Ultimately, that does not produce sustainable health in an individual. I think the only place that I have any right to expect comes out of the promises of the scriptures where God says, I am an ever-present help in your time of need. Come to the throne of all grace. Israel wandering through the wilderness didn't have health care insurance. I mean, I just kind of go like, this is a modern day argument that doesn't stack up anywhere in history as a point of legitimacy. You know, do I care? Sure, I care. Would it be nice if we could solve all this? Yes, I do. But
I'm not hearing sincerity here.
Okay, you're missing my heart.
Okay.
I do think that when you look at this, I think a lot of people are arguing that I'm hearing in the emails that you're reading.
Yeah.
Find a voice of a different opinion, but I still hear it coming from a standpoint of a sense of entitlement, of expecting the government should do for us. And I'm going like,
well, you're characterizing it that way. In both of these, what I've heard is, wouldn't we who have extra... Wouldn't society want to be compassionate? Not, we who don't have any need more, more, more. That's not either one of them are arguing that. What they're saying is, wouldn't society that claims to hold a value to grace, and to, particularly the individuals who hold a value to grace, wouldn't we think of how do we help address the economic healthcare needs of people in our culture who don't have access to it? Because they can't afford it, and because we're the only Western society that hasn't found a way to answer that other than to say, you're on your own, do whatever you want. Now, I appreciate people have the faith in God that says he will be my provider, and I'll stand in that place, but most people don't have that.
That's not even true. There's single emergency room on the planet that gets to close its doors to somebody that comes in with a need. I mean, I
agree.
The very claim that, well, they don't have access to, excuse me, the whole reason we're in the predicament that we are.
Right, but healthcare isn't all crisis-oriented. It's getting sure your kid has the right nutrition, the right shots, what my granddaughters get. Would I not want every child to get that in this culture? And the fact is, I do. My problem with some of these emails is I don't trust government to make that fix. That's where I think that's where the American mindset is a bit different. Our government is full on corrupt. And you might say, well, I'm just criticizing from the sidelines.
No, I'm not.
I've been involved behind the scenes. I've volunteered a ton of my time.
Yeah.
Sarah and I do give money to help people who are in less advantageous places than we are. So to assume I'm not, first of all, is you're assuming facts, not in evidence. But secondly, I do agree that our society could find a greater measure of compassion.
Amen. No disagreement.
I just don't think our congressional elected officials these days have
the
any
means by
sense
which we get there.
Of the common cause or what's fair, but are simply selling themselves and their office to special interest groups like Wall Street, insurance, whatever. And whatever health insurance thing they're going to come up, is it better than nothing? Maybe it is. I won't argue with Patty there. But is it what it can be? No. And I think that's where a lot of us fall. It's not that we're not for grace and compassion. It's just that government...
Yeah, I don't even know where you get that conclusion. The reality is that I'm not threatened by this, but if if you take a monolithic approach to solving what needs to be a neighborly reality, you're never going to do it. You're never going to plug all the holes. You're never going to fix all the cracks. There's no way to accomplish that. And I think one of the things that
I guess the hope is we'll plug some of them.
Sure.
Because you're not going to plug them all.
Sure,
no,
yeah. I mean, to the little kid on the beach that, you know, all the starfish are dying, he's throwing them back. Well, what, kid, what are you doing anything? Well, at least it matters to this one. I understand that.
You're mocking that.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
See, you're misinterpreting my tone of voice on a number of
things. I'm helping other people who are, too, going, that Brad, he sounds a little tense.
I think at the core of all this, if you remove this from what's my personal responsibility, I think you've messed the whole argument. I think the issue is, what do I need to do? How am I helping? Am I cursing the darkness, or am I turning on the light? Am I taking care of the people around me? If each and every one of us focused on that, I do think the world would become a little better place. If I think that it's the job of that group, that thing, that whatever, putting that theory on it, well, good luck, but I think that's a little bit of an abdication of our own personal responsibility to be salt and light. I don't see Jesus suggesting the solution in scriptures is to appeal to government and get government to do those things that we should be doing.
But you have government doing so much other crud with our money that I
would... Total agreement with you there.
I would be very happy to work with people who wanted to find a real solution to the healthcare crisis. Like I said, going into this, my wife had a Cadillac program when she was working for a public school district, and some like 30% of employees in the U.S. work for government entities that have Cadillac health programs.
Right, and that's why the rest of the programs are bankrupt, because of the pensions and the benefits and the entitlements that we heaped upon government.
If I could finish my point, I was simply going to say this. If government was interested in fixing health care, I think they would be as interested in spreading out some of that Cadillac, even congressmen's own health insurance pension programs. Spread some of that money out to help the poor. Then you're going to find other people willing to spread their money out too. But I think the point of both of the letters, I don't think they were about government should do this and that. I think it's about, wouldn't compassionate people care about those who are not able to care for themselves? And it'd be nice to say that everybody can, but there's some that can't. They really don't have the tools or the mechanisms to pay off a 5-year medical thing by working their tail off. I wish they did. They don't. How is it the society responds to that? I do think our culture is about – I think when other people overseas say we have it and it seems it's not perfect, but it works better than your system that only satisfies the haves and doesn't look to care for the have-nots, I think there's a point to be made here and something more that we need to look at up the road.
Amen.
Not on this show, though, because we're moving back from politics, back to that living in the certainty of who Jesus is, regardless of how screwed up the rest of the situations in my life might be.
Yeah,
and that's a challenge.
Yeah, I guess in the whole rancor and debate that surrounds a lot of this, I still just go like, you know what? I don't know how to solve all that. I don't even have any hope that there's going to be a solution that comes out of that where – I don't want to get lost in the theory and the debate is the fact that, you know what? What matters is what I do personally and how I live in such a way that does reflect the heart of God's love for the world, not in words only. But indeed, I mean, I love St. Francis of Assisi. Go forth, proclaim the gospel, and if necessary, use words. I love that. I think most people in America are speechless. Could you say something like that? They don't know what to do. But I don't even know that it's about, quote, America. It's like, you know what? This is a reality of, do I love my neighbor? Do I care for that person? I didn't say love the next country. He said love your neighbor. I think those are achievable. Those are things that we can embrace in.
And those are places we can make a difference. But I think it's a great reminder, because I think sometimes we hunker down in the whole reality of just surviving our own lives. We really forget. Una Shriver dying, and one of the things said is, you know, what have you done today to make the world a better place? I just go, that's a great question.
Yeah.
That we can all be asking in our prayer time. God, what am I doing today? What have you asked me to do in the world that makes it a little more gentle, a little more loving, a little more friendly, that gives a hand up to somebody who needs it? And I think that's a great way we can all be thinking. And I know government tries to and probably doesn't do it well. But I'm all for more compassion in the world. Appreciate the notes. Appreciate people willing to
ding us,
talk about
it.
The dead cow and the, or the dead elephant in the living room or whatever. So until next time.
Thank you for traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.